We are taking a deep dive into a foundational piece of metallurgy that completely shatters that illusion. Because the steel holding up that bridge is, it's not just a static object at all. It is a frozen record of microscopic chaos.
It really is.
So we're digging into a 1989 paper from the journal Materials, Science, and Engineering A. It's written by J.R. Yang and H. KDH Padeshia, and it's titled Reostenitization Experiments on Some High-Strength Steel Weld Deposits.
Right.
And our mission today is to sort of explore the invisible baking and unbaking processes that happen inside the metal of a high-strength weld. We want to see how engineers actually predict these chaotic microscopic structures to ensure the world around you doesn't just, you know, snap under pressure.
Yeah, because the act of welding is often completely misunderstood. People think it's simply melting two pieces of metal so they stick together, kind of like hot glue.
Right, just melting plastic.
But in reality, it is an incredibly violent thermal event. It completely tears down and rebuilds the microscopic architecture of the steel. And to grasp how engineers predict the strength of a weld, we have to look closely at a mechanism called reostenitization.
Okay, let's define that term before we go any further. Because, well, reostenitization is definitely a mouthful.
It is, yeah.
Essentially, it's the process of steel transforming from a phase called ferrite back into a phase called austenite as the metal heats up. Did I get that right?
You did, yeah. So at room temperature, the steel in a standard weld is primarily in that ferrite phase. And if you look at an atomic level, the iron atoms are arranged in what we call a body-centered cubic structure.
Okay.
It's relatively spacious, structurally speaking. But when you hit that steel with a welder's torch and push it past a very specific critical temperature, the internal crystal structure physically shifts.
Like it actually moves around?
Exactly. The atoms rearrange themselves into a face-centered cubic structure, which is what we call austenite. And then if you let it cool down again, it shifts back into ferrite. That specific phase change and, you know, exactly how it happens governs the ultimate toughness of the metal joint.
Got it. So to give you, the listener, a mental picture of what's happening during a real-world multi-run weld, which is where a welder lays down multiple continuous layers or runs of molten metal to fill a deep joint think about trying to frost a cake with boiling hot icing.
I love this analogy.
Right. So you lay down the first layer of cake, and it sits there, and it cools. But then you pour on the next layer of hot icing. The heat radiating from that fresh molten top layer physically melts and changes the internal structure of the cake layers underneath it.
Yep, it absolutely does.
So every single new pass of the welding torch is actively heat treating the metal that was just deposited moments before.
And that hot icing heat penetration is forcing the older, cooler weld beads below it to heat up again, which forces the atoms to shift from ferrite back into austenite.
Oh, I see.
Then, as the torch moves away, it rapidly cools back down into ferrite. That constant violent cycling, heating, shifting, cooling, shifting back, that's what makes the final microscopic structure of a multi-run weld incredibly difficult to map out.
Which means if we want to understand how the hot icing melts the cake, we first have to understand what the starting cake actually looked like under a microscope. Like before the heat hits it, what are we even looking at?
Well, in this paper, the researchers isolated two very specific starting microstructures of ferrite to study. One is called bainite, and the other is called acicular ferrite.
Okay.
And in the context of their experiments, both of these microscopic shapes are they're mixed with tiny amounts of leftover residual austenite.
So let's paint a visual picture of those two structures, bainite and acicular ferrite. What do they actually look like if we zoom way in with an electron microscope?
Their geometries are actually distinct, and that entirely dictates how they behave. So bainite forms by nucleating or sprouting from the outer surfaces of the austenite grains.
Okay, from the outside in.
Right. And as it grows inward, it forms very neat parallel plates. Metallurgists call these groupings sheaves. If you look at an image of it, it strongly resembles a very orderly stack of lumber.
Stack of lumber. Got it. That's easy to picture.
Acicular ferrite, though, operates on completely different rules. It does not start at the edges of the grain. It nucleates internally.
Wait, from the inside?
Yeah, springing out from tiny impurities or microscopic inclusions floating right in the middle. And because it's growing outward from these central points in multiple directions at once, it forms chaotic, non-parallel interlocking plates.
Oh, okay.
It's a messy interwoven structure, much more like a microscopic basket weave.
Okay, so To test how these two different structures, the stacked lumber and the basket weave bake and unbake, the researchers designed what they call isothermal experiments.
Yes, exactly.
They took a highly specific chemical mixture of high-strength steel, which they called alloy H1, and they held it in a furnace at exactly 460 degrees Celsius for 30 minutes.
Right, very controlled.
So this locked the metal into perfectly baking either that bainite structure or that acicular ferrite structure. And then they rapidly cranked the heat up to about 680 degrees Celsius to see how fast each shape would turn back into austenite.
The underlying goal there was to separate the variables. The researchers were really trying to figure out how the starting geometric shape of the ferrite affects the raw speed of its transformation back into austenite.
Hold on, that actually doesn't make sense to me.
Why not?
Well, if bainite and acicular ferrite are both created from alloy H1, the chemical ingredients are absolutely identical. I mean, we're dealing with the exact same amounts of iron, carbon, and trace metals. So why wouldn't they react to the heat and transform at the exact same speed?
It is the most intuitive assumption to make, honestly. If the chemistry is identical, the reaction to heat should be identical. But we have to firmly separate thermodynamics from kinetics here.
Okay.
Thermodynamics governs what is physically possible. Because the chemical makeup of both structures is identical, the thermodynamics dictate that both have the exact same potential to transform into austenite. The energy states are the same.
Okay, so the potential is the same. They both can do it.
But kinetics dictates the speed of the journey. And this is really the paper's first major finding. Even though their chemical makeup was a carbon copy of one another, the parallel plates of bainite transformed back to austenite significantly faster than the chaotic weave of acicular ferrite.
That is wild. It's wild that physical shape alone can just outmuscle the fundamental chemistry of the metal. What is actually driving the speed limit there?
It all comes down to microscopic real estate. The researchers used a transmission electron microscope to painstakingly measure something called the surface area per unit volume.
Sounds complicated.
They represent this in the math with the symbol S sub V. Basically, they were calculating exactly how much border wall existed between the ferrite plates and the residual austenite.
Oh, I see. And they found that the neat parallel plates of bainite have a surprisingly high surface area ratio. I think it was about 2.14 inverse micrometers. But the interlocking chaotic plates of acicular ferrite have a significantly lower surface area ratio, around 1.56 inverse micrometers.
Exactly. And that mathematical difference in surface area fundamentally alters the kinetic speed of the metal.
I think I have a way to visualize this for you guys listening. Think about taking a solid block of ice and setting it on your kitchen counter, and then taking that exact same volume of ice, but crushing it up into tiny pieces and setting it next to the block.
Oh yeah, perfect.
The crushed ice is going to melt much, much faster. The total volume of water is identical, just like our alloy H1 chemistry is identical. But the crushed ice has vastly more surface area exposed to the warm air.
Yes.
So the bainite is our crushed ice. Because it has more surface area, there are simply more front lines exposed for the transformation to take place.
That crushed ice effect translates perfectly to the atomic mechanics of steel. The transformation from ferrite to austenite isn't an instantaneous flip. It requires immense physical movement at the atomic level.
Right.
The researchers actually modeled the growth of the austenite as being one-dimensional carbon diffusion controlled.
Let's break down that phrase, one-dimensional carbon diffusion controlled. What is actually moving around inside the solid metal?
Remember how we talked about the atomic lattice shifting earlier?
Yeah.
Austenite, with its face-centered cubic structure, has a lot more empty space between the iron atoms than ferrite does. Because of that, austenite acts like a sponge for carbon. It can hold much more carbon dissolved inside it. Ferrite, on the other hand, rejects carbon. So as the austenite boundary line moves forward, consuming the ferrite, it is literally sweeping up all the excess carbon in its path.
But the carbon has to go somewhere, right?
It has to literally diffuse. The carbon atoms have to physically migrate through the solid metal lattice to get out of the way of the advancing boundary. If we picture the carbon atoms as a massive crowd of people at a concert, and the stage is expanding into the crowd, the people have to slowly shuffle out of the way.
Oh, man. And if you have a massive, long stage front, like a huge surface area like we see in the bainite, you have way more room for that carbon crowd to move across the boundary simultaneously.
Exactly.
The flow is wider, so the transformation speeds up. But with the acicular ferret, the surface area is mathematically smaller. You've created a bottleneck.
Yeah, a huge bottleneck.
The carbon simply can't shuffle out of the way as fast, so the physical growth of the austenite slows down.
Looking at it as a geometry and traffic flow problem completely explains the speed difference. But there is a glaring problem with that perfect crushed ice laboratory theory.
Which is?
Well, it relies on a perfect, stable lab oven holding the metal at an unchanging temperature. Real welders out on a construction site don't work in a vacuum. They blast cold steel with erratic, violent heat.
Right. So the researchers knew they had to get out of the static lab conditions and simulate the fire of the real world. I mean, does that microscopic geometry still dictate the speed limit when the temperature is constantly moving?
That was the big question.
And this brings us to their continuous heating transformation experiments, or CHT. They wanted to see what happens when the heat is actively rising, just like under a welding torch. They took their alloys, alloys 1, 2, and 3, and subjected them to heating rates ranging from a painfully slow 0.006 degrees Celsius per second, all the way up to a rapid 56 degrees Celsius per second.
And to capture data during such rapid temperature shifts, they utilized a piece of highly sensitive equipment called a high-speed dilatometer.
I just have to say, I love the retro tech detail of this setup. To run the sophisticated dilatometer and log the data, the researchers hooked it up to a vintage 1980s BBC Acorn microcomputer.
That's right, yeah.
The idea of this massive industrial metallurgy experiment being monitored by the exact same 8-bit computer architecture you might have used to play, like, basic text adventure games in the 80s, it's just incredible to me.
It's pretty funny. The computing power might have been vintage, but the physical science of the dilatometer is brilliant. A dilatometer measures infinitesimal changes in the physical length of a metal specimen.
Okay.
Usually when you heat a piece of metal, thermal expansion makes it grow longer. But when steel reaches that critical temperature and the atoms suddenly rearrange from the spacious ferret structure into the tightly packed austenite structure, the entire piece of solid metal actually shrinks for a brief moment.
Wait, it shrinks?
Yes, even as the temperature continues to rise.
Wow. So by hooking this metal rod up to a highly sensitive gauge, that Acorn microcomputer isn't like looking at the metal with a camera. It's just feeling for that microscopic physical contraction to know the exact millisecond the crystal structure is shifting inside.
Precisely. And when they ran these continuous heating experiments on what they called the as-deposited weld, meaning raw, chaotic metal straight out of a real-world welding process rather than their carefully baked lab samples, the dilatometer registered something completely unexpected.
Yeah, the transformation from ferret to austenite started at a significantly lower temperature than the models predicted.
Way lower.
In the carefully controlled isothermal lab tests, the transformation didn't kick off until about 695 degrees Celsius. But in the real world, as deposited weld metal, that microscopic contraction began at roughly 630 degrees.
And a 55 degree drop in the starting temperature of a fundamental phase change is massive in metallurgy. It indicated that the as-deposited weld metal was somehow primed and eager to transform, requiring far less thermal energy to kickstart the process.
So, does the entire thermal history of the metal, like how quickly and chaotically it cooled down the very first time it was deposited as a liquid, actually rewrite its physical rules for the future?
The thermal history permanently alters the thermodynamic baseline. It really does. It all comes back to the carbon diffusion crowd we discussed earlier.
The concert crowd.
Exactly. When a weld cools down continuously in the real world, it's not a perfect uniform process. The metal freezes rapidly. That rapid, continuous cooling traps vastly different, uneven concentrations of carbon in the tiny residual austenite pockets left between the ferret plates.
Oh, so the metal isn't reaching a clean, relaxed state at all. It's holding on to some microscopic baggage from its past.
That's a great way to put it. Because the starting carbon level in those real-world microscopic pockets is artificially higher and more chaotic than in the perfectly baked lab samples, it alters the thermodynamic equilibrium. It effectively lowers the energy barrier required to trigger the phase change. The metal is basically spring-loaded. When you hit it with heat the second time around, it makes the leap back into austenite much faster and at a much lower temperature.
Incredible. And as if the geometry of the plates and the hidden thermal history wasn't complex enough for engineers to map out, the researchers found one more variable that completely flips the script on how this metal behaves. And it involves an impossibly small trace element added to the chemistry.
Yes, this becomes really clear when we look at the difference between alloy 1 and alloys 2 and 3. The foundational chemistry, you know, the iron, the carbon, the manganese, it's basically the same. But alloys 2 and 3 contain a tiny addition. They have roughly 0.2% molybdenum.
0.2%. I mean, that sounds like a statistical rounding error. How could a fraction of a percent of a single element possibly override the entire structure?
In high-strength steel design, a tiny fraction of a percent of an alloying element is often the difference between a bridge that sways in the wind and a bridge that cracks. This tiny addition of molybdenum revealed a highly peculiar kinetic effect. Depending on the temperature and the speed of the heating, molybdenum acts as a thermodynamic double agent.
Right. I was thinking of molybdenum like a fair-weather sports fan. Like, at low temperatures when the heating is slow and things are relatively chill, molybdenum is wearing a ferrite jersey. It actively stabilizes the ferrite structure, making it incredibly difficult for the metal to transform into austenite. It just digs its heels in and cheers for the home team.
It does. But once the heating rate is cranked up rapidly, like under the intense, immediate blast of a welding arc, molybdenum totally switches jerseys.
Unbelievable.
Suddenly, at high temperatures, it starts cheering for the austenite team. It stabilizes the austenite, actively encouraging and accelerating the transformation.
It's totally counterintuitive to have a single trace element resist a phase change early on, but then actively accelerate that exact same Fink change a few seconds later just because the heat is moving faster. What is the actual mechanism making the molybdenum flip allegiances like that?
Well, it comes down to a physical phenomena known as solute drag. Molybdenum atoms are physically quite large compared to iron atoms.
Okay.
At lower temperatures, as that boundary line tries to move forward to grow the austenite, these large molybdenum atoms cluster along the border. They act like boulders in a stream, creating physical friction or drag that slows the moving boundary down. It stabilizes the ferrite simply by getting in the way.
So the molybdenum is forming a microscopic barricade.
Essentially, yes. But when you crank the heating rate up rapidly, the thermal driving force becomes so immense that it overpowers that friction.
Oh, I see.
The moving boundary gets so much energy that it simply breaks free and leaves the large molybdenum atoms behind. Once that drag effect is shattered by the high heat, the thermodynamic balance completely flips, and the presence of molybdenum actually makes the austenite phase more thermodynamically stable.
Okay, we have to pause here and connect this intensely microscopic physics back to you, the listener. Because why should you, going about your daily life, care about 0.2% of molybdenum acting like a barricade inside a microscopic crystal?
You should care because of the real-world stakes involved in heavy engineering. When mechanical engineers and material scientists are designing the steel framework for a skyscraper or the pressure hull of a deep-sea submarine, they aren't just looking at the static strength of a beam.
Right.
They have to calculate exactly how that specific alloy will behave when a welder comes along and blasts it with a localized torch to join it to another massive plate.
Because if the engineers don't account for the fact that the tiny dash of molybdenum is going to suddenly switch teams and stabilize the austenite during that rapid heating cycle,
then the final microscopic structure of that critical welded joint will be completely different from what they modeled on paper. Instead of a tough, resilient joint, they might end up with a structure that is highly brittle or susceptible to microscopic cracking under stress.
That's terrifying.
Knowing that this 0.2% of molybdenum fundamentally rewrites the kinetic rules under the intense heat of a torch is quite literally the difference between a structurally sound, lifelong connection and a catastrophic failure when the wind blows too hard.
Let's take a breath and recap the journey we've just been on, because we have traveled from massive bridges all the way down to the movement of individual carbon atoms.
We really have.
We started with the realization that the starting shape of the microscopic structures inside the metal, you know, the parallel stacked lumber of bainite versus the chaotic interlocking basket weave of a acicular ferrite, actually dictates the physical speed of the metal changing phases. Geometry and surface area beat out pure chemistry.
Absolutely. And from there, we explored how the continuous chaotic heating and cooling of real-world welding alters the pristine predictions we make in a laboratory.
The real world is messy.
Very messy. The rapid freezing of a real weld traps uneven carbon in the lattice, effectively preloading the thermal spring and lowering the temperature threshold for future structural changes.
The metal actually holds a physical memory of its thermal trauma. That's just so cool. And finally, we unpacked how large trace elements like molybdenum can create solute drag, acting as microscopic barricades that completely reverse their behavior depending on how fast the heat is applied.
Yeah, so every time you look at a massive welded steel structure now, a skyscraper, an offshore oil rig, a crane, try not to just see a static cold piece of metal. Think about the invisible thermal history locked inside it.
Yeah.
Every single weld bead represents a microscopic battlefield. It's a place where thermodynamics, the geometric surface area of crystal structures, and the high-speed diffusion of carbon atoms all fought it out in fractions of a second. The outcome of that lightning-fast war is the very strength holding that structure up in the sky.
And here is something else to think about as we wrap up. If a single pass of a welder's torch creates this much microscopic chaos and rewriting of thermal rules, think about the future of manufacturing.
Oh, absolutely.
Think about modern 3D printed metal. Additive manufacturing is essentially millions of tiny sequential microscopic welds layered on top of each other over and over again. The hot icing is constantly hitting the cake.
Yeah, the thermal cycles there are mind-boggling.
Right. Engineers today aren't just designing the outer aerodynamic shape of a 3D printed rocket engine. They are currently trying to tame millions of intersecting, highly complex thermal histories at the exact same time. It makes you realize that the hardest part of building the future isn't the grand design. It's controlling the microscopic chaos hiding inside the materials we use.